Hey everyone, I'm super, super excited to have with us a very special guest for Found the Stories. Today we have the absolute honor to host our dear friend Shachar. Shachar is the founder of an incredible company called Stoke Talent, which has an amazing, amazing story and was recently acquired by an incredible company called Fiverr. And we'll get all into that. Besides that, Shachar is the father to three beautiful children, the husband to a great wife, and he actually met his wife at 14 years old. So I'm sure we could get into a lot of marriage tips and marriage advice and how to upkeep relationships. But besides that, I am very excited to have Shachar with us today in order to really learn how to become the best version of yourself and to show up every single day. Shachar has the most incredible career. He's worked at multiple big companies, but also he himself has been someone that's always been overcoming obstacles and asking himself, why not me? So I am very excited to learn all about Shachar's framework of mind, his mindsets, and what he does in order to become the best version so that we can learn from that and apply those things to our own lives. So Shachar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here, man. I'm stoked. Such a great opening. So I can't wait to see what's next. It can only go downhill from here.
Well, you can hire me full time to be your opener and I can walk around with you and introduce you to people. Let's get started. You recently sold your company for an incredible amount of $110 million to Fiverr. Amazing. And we're going to get into, obviously, the whole entire process over there. But I want to start off with the founder mindset. The mindset between before selling your company and after selling your company. It's two different types of applied pressures. Your thought processes are different. So I want to start with that.
Someone asked me at some points, like, you know, how excited are you that you sold the company? It's like, is there a moment of elevation? And to be honest, when I sold the company, right, I'll speak for myself. It's like I haven't sold multiple companies yet, so I don't know how it feels. So I have an experience of one. But for me, selling the company was like winning a big deal, large deal. It wasn't like a completely different thing. I didn't wake up the next morning and felt like anything was significantly different. It's like getting a big deal. You go out for drinks and then, you know, a new quarter starts and you have new targets to hit. So the feeling is very similar. It's like it's a big win. It's mostly the recognition that you've built something of value. I think that was the biggest thing. The biggest thing in a mindset from a day-to-day operation, though, when you're a founder, you're constantly thinking, definitely 2021. By the way, 2021, being a founder on the one end was great because, you know, valuations were great. You could raise money. On the other end, pressure was extremely high. Everyone's raising on, you know, valuations are insane. If you're not raising on $1 billion, you're a failure. That was a mindset, you know, and that was what being founder in 2021 felt like. If you're not raising twice a year, going to unicorn state within 2 to 3 years, you're doing something wrong. And so there's constant pressure and the competition is not against results, which is part of what you're doing is, you know, hitting your numbers, but it's also looking sideways constantly. Hey, they just raised. Hey, they raised again. How come they raised twice and I'm not even on my way to my next round? Like, there's constantly that pressure, which is very not healthy. On the other hand, it's very difficult to get disconnected. It's like you open your TV and every week on the news, like new unicorns, you open the paper, it's there. You go up in the elevator in the Tel Aviv scene of startups, like you run into, hey, they just closed their run and Jay just closed their run. You know, they just got in a run from Insight and Tiger just invested. You have that pressure constantly. Obviously, once you get acquired, then you're in the pit, right? You're no longer in that race. But you kind of start sensing a different type of pressure and that you want to prove to the company that acquired you that they've done a good deal. You want to feel like they got a decent deal. They bought the right product. You're engaging. You're producing significant value. And that's a new type of pressure that you never had before. Before that, you had a board. I told my wife once, you know, board on the one end, no one pressures you on a day-to-day basis. But once a quarter, man, do you get squeezed. Now you're within a company, you're back into that. Okay, I'm reporting to Micha's Fiverr CEO. It's a different structure. All of a sudden, there's different processes. And you all of a sudden, you're a lot more worried about your team engaging with the rest of the organization. So I'd say it's very different types of pressure. It's not gone. It's just different.
So I want to take a step back and go back to the first pressure you mentioned of being a founder and being able to block out the outside noise. Totally agree. And I love what you said, the fact that like it's so difficult as a founder, like you could be building your company and you know you have a better product and a great traction, but you're having that difficult time raising funds. And then you have the company right next to you in your office right next to you, similar stuff, no product, all of a sudden raises $100 million out of the bag. And like that feeling within you is just like, I wouldn't call it the spirit, but it's like really a depressing feeling. How do you block out that outside noise?
Hey, I don't think you can really block it. You can't. Well, you have to be very, very strong minded. Maybe I should start putting tefillin after all to be strong minded. But I think you're at a point where I think it calls to some level of maturity. I think what we're seeing in 2021, part of it was this race, the insane valuation is going to, I think, backfire at some point on younger entrepreneurs that chase the extreme valuation and the cheap money out there. And at some point, they'll go for down rounds, which is the shittiest situation for any company. And you can't fully block the pressure because your board, whatever you do, your board's going to say, well, you know, they're growing 10x. Why are you growing 5x? And it doesn't matter what you're going to do. You're going to get that pressure. I think experienced entrepreneurs or strong-minded people, if you will, there's only one thing you can control, and it's not valuation. It's execution. Focus on your mission. Focus on the numbers. Focus on getting the right people. This is what you should care about. You can fix and you cannot change how quickly you raise and what's the valuation you're getting. Those two are going to be the output of your execution. Now, there are outliers, and there's a lot of those. And I don't know if you're watching We Crashed Now on Apple TV Plus. When you know you're running into a great storyteller like Adam Newman obviously was, or someone like that really sells on a tremendous dream that people have this FOMO, it's like, we got to be in any valuation. And then it completely distorts the entire concept of, you know, execution or anything, because that you really get valuations to get disconnected. But I guess you have to be who you are. It's like, you know, being in your 40s and complaining you're not Warren Buffett. You're not going to become Warren Buffett by worrying that you're not Warren Buffett. Warren, focus on building successful businesses. You might become Warren Buffett.
That's the only way. I love your mindset. Your mindset. And also, like, the mindset you have is only something that's able to come through vast experience. Meaning a founder that's 23 years old, is not thinking the way you're thinking. You know, he's thinking because he's just launching his career. And the way to have that thought process is because he's been through all those different types of experiences. You've been through multiple different types of bubbles, recessions. You worked at vast companies.
By the way, I think there's a tremendous advantage to being a 22, 25-year-old founder, which I'm not taking away for a second. You know, people my age, you know, I'm 46 years old, but people that are laid out entrepreneurs, 35, 40 and over, the challenge we have is when we found a company, there's so much we've seen, we know the risks. And when you know the risks, you're a lot more hesitant in, should I do it this way? There's a better way. You know, I know what's behind door number two. Maybe I should think. When you're 25 years old, it's like, I don't know, I'm going to just run and the heck with it. It's going to be fine. And in a lot of cases, it's fine. You work it out when you hit a wall. And there's a story back in the, I think it was the 80s, maybe 90s. I remember which president it was. He asked the head of NASA, when I'm going to land someone on Mars. And the guy said, it's 2030. It's like, why don't we need 35 years to get someone on Mars? We placed someone on the moon 30 years ago. And that took us like 5 years. Why don't we need 30 years? He said, we didn't know the risks back then. And, you know, and now that you know the risks, all of a sudden, oh, yeah, we need to plan it out. We need to be careful. We need a prudent approach. We need to be careful in how we spend our money. We need to build it this way. It's like, we need to value if there's a market. And so I think that's the advantage and that's the risk as well.
That brings up another point of like, being able to operate from first principles, how important it is as a founder in order to go from there. Because when you're operating from first principles, you're removing all the way those obstacles. You're removing all the way those risks. Take, for example, the moon. If you're thinking about the process, how come we couldn't do it until now? Because of this thing, because of that thing, because we don't have this technology. But when you start removing away all the obstacles from there and you start taking it from a different approach, you're like, wait, maybe I can do that.
If you think about that, you know, go back to the Apollo project or Mercury project back in the 50s, 60s. Had they avoided all risks back then? Eliminated risk, we probably wouldn't hit the moon. If they said, you know, whatever we do, we can't lose any astronauts, no one can die, like we wouldn't hit the moon. You got to carry the risks. And the risks are, you know, it's like it's financial risk, it's, you know, taking burden on the family when you found a company. It's like everything is that you got to be able to handle the risk. I think the propensity to take risk is higher when you're younger. And a lot of time you take the risk and it works out well.
So then talk to me about this 45-year-old guy that was at a company. Had three kids, a wife. And he's like, you know what? I'm getting fed up with this corporate world. Let me go ahead and take that risk and start a startup. So first of all, what was that conversation with your wife saying, hey, sweetheart, I'm going to go ahead and take this risk. We might be in the red for a little bit. You know, we don't have that many funds because I'm going to plow all my money into starting a startup. But also from your own self, like, what was that conversation with yourself saying, you know what? I got to here 45. I'm going to go ahead and start something. Because a lot of times, if you don't have that entrepreneurial drive, at 45, people are like, okay, I'm mid-career level. Let me start working towards retirement right now.
So in my head wasn't in retirement yet. But to your point, I wasn't 100% sure that I'm going to found a company. I had a healthy career. I was an executive in a company. And I was like, I want something fun to do. More than anything else, I wanted to find a place where I'm going to have fun. Not that I was not having fun where I was, but, you know, generally in my career, I ended up switching jobs every 4 years, give or take. That's my tenure within a company. I usually get bored after that. I need a new, you know, something new to work on. So I was getting to that point. And I started meeting, you know, CEOs. Where do I want to go work for? Is it going to be interesting enough? And what's the potential? Because, and the potential was, A, am I going to have fun? And B, will it have the financial upside? Because the last company I worked for, Kenshu, you know, I joined in and the story was, hey, it was 2014. Join us. We're going to go public within a year. I didn't go public yet, even today. And so from a financial standpoint, I never had that experience of going and making any significant money, if you will. Not that I complain. I still had a decent life. And so, you know, I looked at a bunch of companies, had offers from a bunch of companies. It's like all these companies were in that, you know, a few hundred employees stage, pretty mature. And I didn't feel like these were the companies that I wanted to join at that point. I didn't feel like I'll be able to make any significant difference. And I didn't feel like it's going to take me to where I want to go. And so I decided I'm taking 6 months off and going to try and build something off my own. The conversation with my wife, by the way, was the easiest because, you know, I didn't wake up one day and kind of say, hey, honey, this is what I want to do. It's like, so we had these conversations along the way. I think the only thing that we kind of made the joint decision, it's like, I'm going to see this through. And, you know, if it means we're going to take some money out of the piggy bank and kind of fund our living for the next, by the way, I took money out of savings for the next 3 years while I was building the company because I said, I don't want the entire family to suffer or miss out having teenage kids just because I decided to fund a company right now. So either it's going to cost, I don't know, $50,000 or $70,000, whatever that was, but I'm not going to burden the family with that. But for me, it was, you know, I felt ready. I felt like I gathered enough experience, got enough credit, had enough relationships with, you know, VCs in Israel, in the Silicon Valley, had enough relationship with senior executives in companies. And I said, you know, I'm going to give this a try. And I was lucky because I was surrounded by people that helped me push forward and actually start this thing.
And I think that's one of the benefits of being an older founder is the fact that you already have, besides the experience part, but you have that vast network of connections to other different companies, to other VCs, people that have been there already that can support you and guide you along the way from a different perspective of being an older founder.
100%. You know, we got our seed investment within 6 days of meeting Eitan, who's the partner in TLV, who led our seed round. And we met him on a Tuesday and we signed the term sheet, I think the following Monday or Tuesday. And I remember we met on Tuesday and we came back to meeting him again, I think on Wednesday, the next day. And when we were there, I heard them, you know, on the phone calling up, getting references for us, me and Hilik, my co-founder. And Eitan was invested in two other companies of people that I worked with in the past. And he got references for us from, it's like, so immediately that accelerated everything because we got, you know, I assume pretty positive feedback. So that accelerated the entire thing. There was no bet taking.
That's what I hear from any investor that invests in an older founder. They say the process is just so much more quicker because you have that data point over there, like that reference point and everything's around that they're able to really scope out. But when you said that 6 month process, right? So you leave your company, you give yourself 6 months. Did you have the idea for Stoke Talent already? Or is like, okay, let me test out a bunch of different things and see what sticks at the end of 6 months to see if I'm going to continue on upon that. Or after 6 months, if I don't find something that's profitable, I'm going to go back to get a regular job. What was it?
So I had two ideas in mind. When I left Kenshu mid-2018, I tried both. I started working on this, building a business case for this, building a business case for the other one. Started talking to co-founders, potential co-founders, CTOs, and made a decision that I'm not making a decision before January of 2019. I'm not jumping into anything. Okay, so it was I gave myself 6 months to not hurry into a decision that I'm going to regret. In November, I had a VC wanting to invest. And I said, you know, I'm not making any decision before January. I'm not taking any funds. I'm going to work this through. I want to interview. I interviewed about 150 CEOs, CFOs, and heads of HR in the pro. I wanted to give myself time. Being an older entrepreneur, I didn't want to just, hey, I'll start a company, see how it works. Like, if I'm going to go into this, I want to have the conviction that I'm investing, you know, my what might be, I didn't know it's going to be a 2.5 year journey. It might have been a 5 or 10 year journey. I want to make sure that I'm invested in something that I can be committed to. And so I did a lot of legwork, you know, spent time in Tel Aviv, flew out to the Bay Area twice during this period to talk to, you know, on my own dime, obviously, interviewed a lot of executives to kind of come back and say, okay, I think I have enough conviction to go build a company. And only then I made the decision. The only decision I made was that I'm not making a decision before January.
What was the decision you made in January?
We started building a company. We started building Stoke. And in February, we signed the term sheet. So from the moment we made the decision, it was, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks until we had a term sheet.
You know, if only that 6 month period would be right now, you wouldn't have to fly all around the world, even though sure, it was much better to do stuff in person, face to face.
Yeah, it's definitely different. I don't know. Probably right. Would be interesting experiment, maybe one day.
So looking back now in the past 16 months, you built something and within 16 months, the most incredible thing, which is amazing to being able to have a turnaround that quickly. Like you said, you're planning for that long-term journey, but what has surprised you the most so far about being an entrepreneur, about building a company?
It's extremely lonely. It's an extremely lonely experience being a founder. And I have a co-founder. I didn't find the company alone. Helix, my co-founder, and you know, we work extremely well together and we're friends, but there's something about the loneliness that I've never experienced before. It's like there's so much on your shoulders that isn't getting shared with anyone else. You know, when something goes wrong, so it's like the board is calling you. There's no one else to blame, if you will, if not that you're looking for someone to blame. You know, when I did my business trips, usually when I, again, being in the industry for about 20 years, when I used to do business trips, I used to go to the office. In the office, you meet people, you go to dinner with them, you go for lunch with them. All of a sudden, when I founded the company and had a business trip, I was all freaking alone. It's like, so you have a good meeting, you know, and we have 10 time zone difference between Tel Aviv and San Francisco. You go out of a good meeting, there's no one to call to celebrate. You have a shitty meeting, there's no one to call to complain. It's like everyone's sleeping. You have dinners alone. You have lunches alone. It's like, oh, I'm spending so much time alone. I feel like I'm solitary. And so that was the one thing that I didn't understand. You know, and I'm not an extremely social person. I don't go to parties and pubs and things like that. So I didn't think it'll be an issue. But this loneliness thing really hit me at some point. It's like, because you want to be able to unload. Luckily for me, I had advisors and the network and people to have the conversation with. It doesn't take it completely away. You're still alone at times. But I think it's extremely important to surround yourself with people that you can have these conversations with. Responsibility doesn't go away, but at least some of the atmosphere.
Do you feel like you grew tremendously more than you ever before in life the past 2 years?
I think, you know, through the negotiation when we sold the company, it was the first time that I felt, I'll go back to a different story for a sec. My dream growing up was to be a fighter pilot. I'm not a fighter pilot, but I did go through flight school. And someone once asked me what it feels like. And it's like, and when you're flying a jet, a fighter, it's almost all your senses come into this. You're at the moment. You're feeling the moment. It's like you're physically, you're mentally focused. It's like all your senses are coming into that point in time. And in a similar manner, I felt like my experience growing up in engineering, being involved in building companies, marketing, building partnerships, negotiation, all that kind of into these few months of negotiating with Fiverr, all of a sudden you kind of reflect and said, I never believed I'll be able to lead such a conversation, such an engagement. And so you reflect and feel like you're growing. I do think I became a little more, what's the right word for it? Balanced, if that's the right word. You know, being a manager, even if you're an executive manager, there's some luxury. You're a very social person. As a CEO, I was a lot more focused on execution and less social, which is something that I think I maybe lost a bit. I see that with other friends that are founders. Again, you carry that burden all the time. There's very few moments where you're kind of completely letting go and kind of feeling, hey, you know, screw it all. I'm just going to have fun, which is something that you can do when you're not.
That's really interesting. I mean, the few points you mentioned, I think the first point you mentioned that I want to go back on, essentially human beings, you know, people, we are the outcome or the output of all our micro macro experiences that we went through in life. So it wasn't like, you showed up to the negotiations of Fiverr the way you showed up because you woke up that day. No, you showed up to negotiations of Fiverr because of all the vast experiences and micro macro experiences you went through in your personal professional life, which was the output for you when you sat at that meeting, which makes me think having all that vast experiences, especially working in the corporate world, you probably had to do a lot of shift of mind. Coming from a corporate world is very bureaucratic, and there's layers upon layers and layers and layers of random unnecessary bullshit. Probably had to change your whole entire mindset. A, you wanted to build your culture, and B, how are you going to build a startup?
100%. And well, the one thing that worked well for me, I moved from, you know, HP VMware at a company called Kenshu, and Kenshu was a 400 or 500 employee company. So it wasn't that bureaucratic, that much of a corporate. And so I think I kind of had a stepping stone towards going for a very small company. By the way, the corporate world, I think, helped me tremendously as we worked the deal through Fiverr, because I understood how they're thinking through acquisitions, right? And I mean, I learned a lot being on the acquiring side to understand how do you get a company to acquire, if you will. You know, I think that part of the biggest challenge that I have as I onboarded and recruited senior leaders to this startup was that shift in mindset that you're talking about. A lot of them are coming from, hey, we're managers. There's a process. There's a way to do things. And in startups, I think the only way to do things is to not have a way to do things. You do what's required. You hustle. You work through. You improvise. It's like there's everything you learn. If you're saying, okay, this is how we do things, it's like you constantly have to change and adapt. I think I was ready for that. I think Hilik, my co-founder, was ready for that. I think the next batch of people that we brought in were a little more, you know, okay, we're joining a company. We're not founders. Like, how do we do things? I remember when I brought in one of my first salespeople, it's like, okay, where's the playbook? It's like, I don't know. You'll need to write it. It's like, that's pretty much that. We don't have anything. So I think that's the shift in mindset that you need to have. And I think, you know, we ended up doing well.
Thank God. Absolutely. Thank God. You know, I'm assuming your wife's probably like, hey, Shachar, go ahead and take another risk. Let's see what comes next time, or go build another company.
She wants her to take a break, not another risk.
What was that feeling when all of a sudden this lump sum hits your bank account and you never seen this type of money before in your personal account? So it wasn't like, all of a sudden it's like, what is that? Like a feeling of like you just robbed the bank or something? Where is this money coming from? Is it even real?
You know, I don't have a good answer because I was never... My wife has this phrase, we never let money lead us. We never let money manage our day-to-day life. We lived okay before. We never deprived ourselves or anything that we thought was important. And it's not going to change us now that we have more than we had before. Someone asked me in one of a different podcast that I was on, you know, what did I buy for myself, or how did I celebrate this, you know, the fact that I can now afford. And I told him, you know, the first thing we did was actually, I gave a portion of my equity to charity, even when we founded the company. So that was the first check that went out, was actually for that. Again, I didn't need to do anything. It was already decided. The only thing that I bought for myself was, I was in New York in, you know, in December for something. I bought myself a Patagonia jacket that I never, for like $96. So I'm not going to change. I'm a simple person. I wear jeans and boots. I don't need fancy clothes or fancy cars. The fact that there's more money in the bag gives you mostly the peace of mind and the confidence to go and do another one day.
And it forges the ability to do more good with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love the fact that you partnered up with God from the beginning. Like you partner up with charity saying, hey, that we're not just here to make money, but we're here to do good, because we are almost like, it's like having a North Star on like why you want to work extra hard to build something very successful in order to make sure that you're able to get more charity.
100%. You know, it's the best feeling. And my wife works for a nonprofit with youth at risk. And so fortunate is the right word, but we hear a lot about cases like these, and it's the most fulfilling feeling that you can get to help people now that you can.
Which essentially, you know, if you think about it, like that's what Stoke Talent is. Essentially, it's helping people that would not have, I wouldn't say another opportunity, but it's helping people being able to really find meaningful careers or meaningful freelancing careers within companies.
Yeah. Again, Stoke connects corporates to the freelance economy. Some of the freelancers on the platform are freelancers, to your point, that this is their way to make a living. Some of them are very highly paid individuals, you know, super experienced marketing, data science, tech people making $300-$400 an hour. They're not in need. But yeah, some of the people around the world that we're connecting through Stoke and the Fiverr platform, obviously, it completely changed their lives now that they can actually get paid in US rates. So absolutely.
So what's your opinion having this whole entire experience and being able to see exactly what's going on within the talent market? You know, everyone's talking about the future work. Future work, what is the future of the future employee too? Remote, seems like it's here to stay. Then you have the whole entire concept where people are going to be working at multiple companies. So not just gonna have just one job, but they'll be doing that at multiple different types of jobs. Another way of, I guess, calling a fancy word for freelancing, yep, almost. But we see a lot of thought leaders putting out a bunch of different thought processes, thoughts on what they think is going to be, and companies setting up for different types of things. Like you have the 4-day work week. What do you think? And what's your opinion?
So first and foremost, no one really knows what the future of work is going to look like, right? There's so much change. No one really knows. We all can contemplate and estimate and evaluate and whatnot, but no one really knows. I think you touched upon a few of the things that we know are happening. Number one, yes, most companies will not go back to 5 days at the office ever. Second, people are going to switch careers a lot more often. Over 50% of workforce is going to be freelancing within the next 5 years. These things we already know. What's going to be beyond that? I don't know. We'll have to see. But I can tell you that any company that will not have a flexible workforce strategy, that will not have freelance strategy, will not be able to thrive or probably not be able to survive. Any company that today isn't deploying a freelance strategy already is like a company not having a mobile strategy in 2010 or not having an internet strategy in 2000. Things are changing so fast, and we're seeing it. We're seeing it with our install base. We're seeing it with customers that we engage with. This change is happening very fast. If you're going to wait to look at the change in the mirror, you might be too late. And it's going to take you time to rise up to that. So every company in every organization, you know, I've been to a LinkedIn conference 2 years ago. It's like the one thing that repeats itself with every CEO, the number one thing they're focused on is talent. That hasn't changed in a long time. It's not new. The thing that has changed is that battle over talent or the competition over talent is significantly changing because the talent you're going to recruit today is not the talent that you used to recruit a decade ago. Their millennials and Gen Z are making the majority of the workforce. They have a different expectation. They want flexibility. They want multiple employers. They want to have different structure. They want to travel. It's like they want a different social construct. If you're going to try and force what you're familiar with or what you want them to do, you're going to lose out on the biggest industry change since the Industrial Revolution.
Wow. You're saying it's that big?
It's huge. It's even bigger. If you think about, again, the DOL and IRS are estimating 60% of workforce freelancing by 2030. Hit that number with any CEO that you're interviewing, they're not seeing that happening. They're not seeing it happening. And hey, we're already talking, 8 years from now, 7 years from now? It's nothing. I remember, you know, I was at VMware when the cloud revolution started happening. I remember 2011 sales kickoff. I stood on stage and said, you know, VMware's number one competitor in risk is AWS. And people are like, what are you talking about? AWS is for startups and students. No enterprise will ever run on Amazon. 2011. It didn't take 7 years. 3 years later, Amazon was de facto place where everything gets built. And so at that point, it was too late for VMware to be relevant in the app space. Same thing is going to happen here. It's moving extremely fast. We're seeing it. We're seeing companies growing their freelance pool by 30% quarterly, not yearly, quarterly, to build more flexibility into workforce, to augment. We're talking to companies that are saying they have 400 and 500 open headcount. For a company to hire 400 people these days, it's a 4-year journey. If you're not going to start thinking about filling out those gaps in a different process, you're going to be left behind.
So from the employee perspective, how do they manage that? I mean, so first of all, it seems like that if we're going that route, it seems like that almost culture will be obsolete to a certain degree. Because, you know, it's almost like checking in, checking out, project-based hiring, project-based things like that. And so the whole company culture, company values, it's more about, okay, let me just work to get paycheck. That's what more of it sounds like.
So I don't think traditional employment is going away completely. Right? I think you're going to find more core teams that you can focus on, that you can nurture, that you can pay more. They're going to work with you longer term. So you're going to make sure you're going to invest in them. But they're going to, each of their managers are going to manage hybrid teams. that are going to have, you know, 20, 30% of the workforce being full-time employees that are outsourcing tasks to freelancers based on need. And so we're going to see a new structure coming to life. I don't think we're ever going to get to a place where there's no full-time employment. I think that at this point in time, I cannot imagine it. You know what? Maybe one day. I don't think there's a reason to think about it yet. But I think the fact that, you know, the millennials, Gen Zs in 2018 in a survey ran in U.S. high schools, 45% of Gen Zs said they will never take traditional employment. 45% said they will never take traditional employment. Think about it. Some of them will regret it, but think about it. It's amazing. So if you think about companies now fighting for talent, all of a sudden their talent pool, available talent pool, is shrinking by half, right? And it's not necessarily the strong half, because the strong half is going freelancing because they're going to set their time. They're going to set the rate. They can move around. They can travel. And so why would I want to work for a single employer? I'm just going to move around. So this is what companies are going to be facing.
That is true, 100%. I'm trying to think deeper. I mean, you get so many ways, like how you see that actually playing out. But like from an employer perspective, you see it already where, for example, where every single child wants to be a creator, a content creator. They want to be another TikTok star. And every single teen is like, you know what? I want to travel the world and go explore the world. I want to go backpacking in Nicaragua and then go to India. And then you see from your younger people like, you know, from the aspect of constantly changing jobs. Every 2 years.
Exactly. So the average tenure is already below 2 years. It's like 1.9 years, which is insane. In any case, so the ramp up of a full-time employee, the cost of full-time employee, the cost of hiring someone, hiring a full-time employee, the cost of the process is almost 30% of their yearly salary. So just imagine that, how much money companies are spending to get someone, to have them join, and then on average, they're gone after 18 months.
I never got that too. And I think like even the whole compensation method from the younger employees has to be changed a certain degree around that, because you're spending so much on the onboarding. And before the onboarding is even complete almost, because like end of the day, anybody onboarding to a company has to give 6-7 months in order to try it out first before they can make any type of decision. And before you know it, it's like 8 months later, 9 months, they're gone. So like the whole thing just doesn't make sense.
And so companies, I understand it, by the way, are adopting a more agile approach. Instead of hiring someone full-time, start with, give them a two-week project. See the outcome, see how the communication is being handled, see how responsive they are. If you like it, get them on a 2 months project. If you like it, then, you know, continue working with them. But why go through a 3 months process without even knowing what they're capable of?
Exactly, which leads to, I see a lot in the trend right now, project-based hiring.
Yep.
You know why I know you know the answer to the correct thing? Is because you led off with saying, I don't know. And most times people say, oh, everyone loves to give their opinion. Everyone loves to talk and showcase. But starting off with, I don't know, is why I know you know.
By the way, it's something that I practice a lot. It's something that I practice, I tell you, with kids, right? When you're a father and you have kids, like it's like when a kid asks you a question, how do I tell him I don't know? I'm his daddy, expects me to know everything. So it's like, it's, you know, from day one, tell the kids, you know, there are things that I don't know. It's okay. You don't need to know everything.
And it's the best answer. It's always, always the best answer. You think about it. Like we're always rushing to either sound smart. We're rushing to provide the answer. Most times we're not listening for the intent of listening. We're listening to provide that answer. So when we're able to just like calm down and even admit and say, I don't know, that has the most humility possible. Say that. And to not get embarrassed from the fact that he's saying, I don't know, is even another level.
Yep.
What are you telling new entrepreneurs now? Now you have the time, hopefully, to mentor and talk to. What are you telling new entrepreneurs that are asking you for their advice about the journey or for advice in general?
To be honest, most conversations that I have with founders are more, now you bring it up, are more practical. So it's like, how do I raise funds? What do I need to bring up? How should I think about the problem space? And that's where I generally help. Founders that I'm more engaged with longer term, you know, it's more difficulties of the journey, but most conversations are more practical. I try and encourage them not to go for obscene funding rounds. I try to encourage them to really feel confident in what they're building and not rush into anything. I try to challenge them. So, you know, I had a friend who called me up and said, hey, I'm working with this founder. Do you mind taking a meeting with him? I'm considering joining his startup. I want to hear your opinion and meet both of them. And after the meeting, he decided not to join him. And he told me the goal of the meeting was, I knew that you're going to challenge him to a point that will help me understand if you really understand what he wants to build. And I think that reflection is super important. I had it with, you know, people that were my mentors pushing you to a point, are you really confident in what you're going to build? Do you really have the conviction? Because if you don't, you don't have the confidence and all you're looking for is to raise a seed round, then this isn't going to end well. You might get lucky, you know, there's always outliers. But generally speaking, don't focus on funding your, on getting your next funding round. Focus on getting the confidence, conviction in the problem, in what's required, and then focus on getting funded. But if you can't answer the questions of your target market, where would you start? What's the fee? And so don't focus on getting the money. Focus on the problem.
True, true. And I agree. But also, doesn't a lot of that confidence come after you've already, I wouldn't say proven yourself, but acquired that customer, then you really know fully with confidence that is like, we're actually working on something over here?
Well, obviously, confidence gets built over time. So the more traction you have, the more feedback you have, you get this traction. But a lot of times I meet entrepreneurs with a nice idea. But when you start, you know, you want to rubber hit the road and you start asking questions like, so are you trying to sell to enterprises or to SMBs? Are like, well, it applies to both. And well, you know, it doesn't really apply to, but who you're focusing on? Well, I'm going to after enterprise. Okay, you'll need a sales team. It's like, no, we're going to do inside sales. Like, inside sales for enterprises generally doesn't work. So you start asking, and you understand, and they understand they haven't thought this through. So they're going to, if you're going to go with that type of approach, A, to a VC, mostly you won't get funded, by the way, because they're going to be on to your lack of experience. And B, you're going to waste, you might waste your next 2, 3, 4 years on going the wrong journey. So challenging is not to depress you, is to push you against a wall so you start searching for the right answers. Most entrepreneurs, and I was that way myself years ago, focusing on building a fun product, a great product. But building a product doesn't build the business. You got to understand how you put that product in the right hands, how you price that product, who's the buyer of the product. And this is where, you know, where I'm challenging these entrepreneurs. Just because you're a tech person or a great product person doesn't mean you can build a company out of that. You need to understand how you turn something into, at the end of it, I mean, I have a good friend of mine, Safwan, told me once, so, you know when companies die? There's only one reason for companies to die. They run out of money. As long as you have money, you can make as many mistakes as you want. And so to build a successful company, at the end of it, you got to be able to generate money. You got to be able to generate revenue. And so if you just build a great product but haven't thought about how to turn it into revenue, you have an issue. Unless you're building open source, which is a completely different beast.
Yeah, it's like one of the biggest problems you see a lot and what people don't focus on is you can have a great product, but if your distribution sucks, then...
Exactly.
Distribution is so important that a lot of times we can make a mistake on the distribution aspect of the startup. Wow. So many incredible points you mentioned in just that small tidbit of everything from being able to, for a real mentor is being able to push back and to ask those hard questions and to really, you know, then you have to obviously face yourself and ask yourself, do I have the answer to those questions really internally? So what are some of the non-obvious habits or things that have made you become better to really face yourself honestly? And to show up as Shachar.
Wow. First of all, as you said, I'm not young anymore. So I had my share of failures building companies, my failure of having people push me and you know, rubbing the failures in my face. I had my shares of, you know, coming up with ideas that have been challenged and I now have good answers to. And, you know, I say two things. A, I read a ton. I don't read as much lately. Just, I don't know. The habit isn't as strong as it used to be. I'm hoping it's just a phase. But I read a lot of business books, a lot of business books about, you know, founders and how they built their companies, what they ended up looking at, what worked, what didn't work, you know, brave decisions. There's a lot of great material out there that didn't exist two decades ago. I mean, you got Ben Horowitz and Jack Welch and Reid Hoffman. There's a lot of good stories out there on how to handle these crossroads. So that's number one. And I think for me, the second thing was, how should I say this? Looking cold-heartedly at building a business and not at building my personal career. And so when you're on the hamster wheel, it's like you want to constantly grow. I want to get the next title. I want to get the pay raise. I want to get the equity grant. I want to get It's like, this is what you're constantly running against. And at some point when you're building, when I build the company, and that's why we ended up selling the company as well. I promised myself, it was just about me. It's like, do I want to sell for 110 again? I'll take you back 6 months ago. Selling for 110 was almost a loser's act, right? When I told the VC we're selling the company for 110, it's like, why? You know, you can go for $1 billion in a year. It's like, that was the mentality in the market back then. And I cold-heartedly looked at the business, the trends, the probabilities. I said, I'm going to treat this as a business. It's not about me and whether I'm going to be on the next, you know, DeMarker or Forbes, you know, fundraising TechCrunch or whatnot. But really look at what's right for the business, not what's right for me. And I think when you're at that point, you're a far better entrepreneur than you're focused on yourself. And I talk to entrepreneurs today, it's like, well, you know, I want to raise a unicorn valuation. Why? Because, you know, you want to look good in front of your friends. You want to tell a good story. Is it the right thing for the company? It might kill the company in the long run because you're not really in that valuation. You know that deep inside.
So honest and so truth. Not letting our ego really get involved in any of the process and being able to like almost separate ourselves from the outcome.
You can't fully separate yourself. Yeah, you can't 100%. I'm not going to lie. No, I'm not completely ego-less. I'm not going to give that impression by any stretch of imagination, but to distance yourself a bit, yes.
You know, mentioning before that you're not young, you know, so flipping the script a little bit to your younger self that is facing the world for the first time coming out of university, you know, what is the message you want to impart to him to let him know? And he has all options in front of him.
You know, it's funny. When I did my BA in computer science and I got a full scholarship from a guy called Efri Arazi. He's too old for most people to know. He founded his first startup company in 78, I think. It was the guy that he was an MIT grad, came out of the Israeli military, was an MIT grad, and he built the camera that broadcasted the Apollo 11 landing on the moon. And so a very sharp guy, well, he passed away a few years back. But when he interviewed me for the scholarship, he asked me, you know, let's assume you graduate computer science. What are you going to do next? And, you know, the obvious answer would be, I'm going to start a startup company. That was what, you know, was. And I said, and by the way, I had no idea what I wanted to do, right? All I wanted to do is get the scholarship, to be honest. I had no idea. But I said, but I do understand that at this point, I need to sound different. That's the only thing. And it said, you know what? I'm going to get a full-time job because I don't want to find a company before I had experience in founding companies. I didn't know shit, but I was like, I'm sure everyone told him I'm going to start a company. I said, no, I'm going to say something different. I did get the scholarship. So I guess the answer worked well. And it ended up being what I did. And really, the race is long. And, you know, when I came out of university, people at 30 didn't start companies. You start companies when you're 24 and then 33 or 34. And I remember when I was 37, I thought, this is it. It's like, this was my last shot. I'm not going to start another company. But the race is long. And do it when you feel like you have the mental capacity, the tenacity. And as when I was a manager, 15 years ago, my indirect manager once told me, in order to be an effective manager, you have to have the capacity to be hated, which is a phrase that I'm thinking. You have to have the if you want people to like you, you can be a great manager. Because being a manager, you fight for things, you disappoint people, you got to fire people. Some people are going to dislike you, even hate you. You have to have the capacity to be hated. If you have the capacity to be hated, you're far more likely to be a successful entrepreneur because you're going to bring on people that you're not going to work with. You're going to have to fight with your co-founders. You're going to have to battle with the board at some point. If you're not ready, I mean, don't pick a fight, but you got to be ready to fight the fight. And so the race is long and you need to grow a thick skin to have the capacity to be hated.
Wow. I love that. I absolutely love that. Chaka, I know we could talk for another hour, no doubt.
And we will. When you're coming to Israel or I'm coming to New York, we'll spend another hour.
Yeah, we'll spend multiple hours together. But I know from the audience perspective, in order to benefit people, like there's so much more, like, I mean, more questions I have because everything you mentioned is we're able to, I guess, uncover it and go a level deeper than what you just mentioned. And then when we reach that level, we could go a level deeper and really get to the core of a lot of stuff in order to bring out a lot more information, which essentially is to impact multiple more people. But I want to thank you. Because, you know, I learned a tremendous amount from this conversation. And for me, a conversation is not the words being spoken, but it's the underlying conversations happening under the words, which is a bunch of different emotions and the feelings and everything else, the unspoken language. And that's really where the conversation is happening and where you're able to take out the most lessons. And I've taken out so, learned so much over there for me, which I'm going to listen to this conversation multiple times in order to apply more stuff. And, you know, some of the things that I've personally learned, a few things, first of all, is the ability to really ask yourself the hard questions. You know, obviously you have a mentor and feedback, but don't be afraid to face yourself to ask the hard questions and be honest with yourself. Really, truly be honest. Don't do it because I want to have my face on the cover of Forbes. Don't do it because of how your friends are going to start respecting you, looking at you different. Do it because you really want to do it from a good place. And there's tremendous examples throughout the whole entire conversation that we're able to bring that out. For example, you know, the first equity shares went to charity and how your lifestyle has not changed. A lot of things around it. And at the same time, the whole entire conversation is full circle, where we started off with, for example, a different type of mindset to ending off where everything, it's a long run, it's a long game. It's a marathon, not a sprint. Where we live in a generation right now where it's instant gratification. It's not about that. It's about take the process. A lot of times we wake up in the morning thinking, going through that mindset, like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do today? Like, oh, my life's in shambles. Yesterday was an incredible day. And today you woke up on the left side of the bed. Okay, you know, instant gratification. Remember, it's a long game. So I personally want to thank you so much. I have learned a tremendous amount. There's no doubt that everyone else that's going to listen to this is going to benefit too. And it goes without saying that I'm obviously here for your family, for Stoke, for yourself, any way I could possibly be of help anywhere possible. So thank you, thank you, and thank you.
Brian, thanks so much for having me here. It's been wonderful, and I'm looking forward for the next time.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for listening to this conversation with Shachar. I hope you enjoyed and you learned something that you're able to apply to your personal or professional life today. If you did benefit from listening, please share it with a friend who you think can benefit too. And please don't forget to subscribe and leave a review. Because when you do leave a review, it helps more people find this podcast so we can do our job in inspiring them too. If your company would like to explore a partnership with the Founder Stories podcast, please reach out to me on LinkedIn at Ephraim Yarmak. Now have a great week, and I hope to see you back very soon.